everyone, and welcome back to the Icy Veins podcast. My name is Patrick Beja, and this is the heart of August, the heart of summer, and it's already the 22nd episode of our show. That's it. This is the last episode before we finally get into the battle for Azeroth. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you enjoy World of Warcraft, and it's every 2 years we get an expansion, and that is what is happening in less than a week. We'll talk about that, and especially what's been leading up to it. We'll also talk about the Boomsday Project, which is out, the finals for the Overwatch League, White Mane in Heroes, and even a little bit of StarCraft. And to help me do all of this, I have, as always, Stan, who's currently cooking in his apartment at 35 degrees Celsius. How's it going?
Hey, guys. It's going quite good, but it's freaking hot, as you mentioned, Patrick. And yeah, so our podcast will be stuffed to brim with lots of news, so I'm really looking forward to cover that.
Yeah, it's going to be really cool, and especially the part about getting angry about what's been happening in WoW, as the entire internet has done in the past couple of weeks. We also have to accompany us through the misty woods of Hearthstone. I don't know what they're misty or woods. That might have been a couple of expansions ago. We have Aleko. How's it going, sir?
It's going amazing. There's this beautiful, like 1 or 2 week period after a new expansion comes out where you get to play all these super janky, really bad combo decks and still win games. So I'm a happy boy.
Very cool. Well, you get your party 3 times a year with a new deck, a new expansion for Hearthstone. For the WoW nerds, it's only every 2 years. But, you know, we're going to talk about WoW, as I mentioned. We're going to do that towards the end of the show because it's full of spoilers. Usually, I don't like to, you know, kind of bury the lead and make people wait for the thing that everyone wants to talk about until the end of the show. But there's so much spoilers in the story part of the news that if you haven't played through that War of Thorns part 2 and 3 yet, or even part 1, we're not going to discuss it until you've had a chance to listen to the whole episode, and then we'll get to it. But as I mentioned before that, we have Heroes, Overwatch, and Hearthstone, which the Boomsday Project is out. And there's, as you mentioned, a bunch of wacky stuff happening. So how's it been going?
Well, it's a little early to call. And I know I have a lot of really good things to say about Hearthstone because I love the game, obviously, but this is already maybe my favorite expansion ever.
Really? I feel like everyone says that every expansion, but
I mean, we might say that because, you know, the meta gets a little bit stale before a new set comes out, and then a new set comes out and everything changes. But this set is just sweet. The theme of it is really, really cool. It's like a mad science set. And the way that the games play out, you really kind of feel like a mad scientist in a lot of ways. There's really? Just a ton of really unique interactions going on that have like never really been added to the game before. Cards have like just really cool names like Boommaster Flurk and Explodinator and Floop's Glorious Gloop and, you know, really cool art. So it just feels right. They really, really, really made the flavor of the set exciting. And then the way the games have been playing out so far have been really fun as well. And then this is something I've mentioned, I think, a bit on like Twitter and some of my articles, but there's also this new card, Whizbang the Wonderful, that basically gives you access to 18 random decks with just one card. So if you're a new Hearthstone player and you don't have a Hearthstone collection, you can kind of craft this one card and get to try out all of the classes. So I really think there hasn't been a better time to start playing Hearthstone if you've been interested in the game. Thanks not just to that card, but also just to the very exciting and, you know, fun nature of the set itself.
So, yeah, that card, it's not the one that you get when you log in, right? There, like, you get to, it's a random legendary you get when you log in, isn't it?
Yeah, well, so you can, it's just a legendary that you can open from, you know, any pack.
Of course,
if you pre-order the set, you get one random golden legendary. And, of course, my pre-order golden random legendary was Whizbang the Wonderful.
Oh, so, nice.
You have a golden one. All of the decks you play are all golden cards, so that's kind of cool.
Ooh.
But fancy. You know, I already have a pretty big collection, so wasn't the most necessary legendary for me.
All right, so tell us about, I think, so we want to talk about maybe one or two decks and how they work to give people an idea of how the set is constructed, but also there's one card in particular that we wanted to discuss, and that's Mechathune. Which one do you want to start with? You get the choice.
Let's start with Mechathun, because this is instantly in my like top five or top 10 favorite cards ever. So let me pull up the text here exactly so I don't misread it. But the Mechathun, what he does, he is a callback, of course, to C'Thun, which is a card from Whispers of the Old Gods. He's a 10-mana 10-10 mech with a Death Rattle. If you have no cards in your deck, hand and battlefield, destroy the enemy hero, which basically means you win the game. So if you can somehow find a way to empty your entire card of hand, or empty your entire hand of cards, have no cards remaining in your deck, and clear your board, you win. That sounds very difficult, but there's already been two or three decks so far which have shown the ability to do that fairly consistently.
Really?
I thought
it was the kind of card that would be just ridiculously powerful, but also kind of dumb because you would never get the win condition. It's so difficult to get to kind of like Giant Dragon, Black Dragonflight, the Cataclysm causing dragon. Mm-hmm. Stan, help me out.
Deathwing,
thank you. Jeez, how can I forget the name of Deathwing? kind of like Deathwing, which burns everything in your hand and kills every minion. But really, it feels powerful, but it's not really usable in decks. You're saying Mechathun might be a bit more usable?
Yeah, actually. So the first, like, very obvious and easy to explain home for it is Mechathun Druid. So if you can empty your deck, play Mechathun for 10, Innervate, which gives you 1 mana, and then Naturalize, which destroys a minion, for 1 mana, boom, there you go. It's already done. So you just have to find a way to draw your whole deck, which Druid can actually do pretty easily with cards like Gadget Zayn Auctioneer and Nourish and etc. And then, yeah, they can just plop down that combo. There are quite a few streamers playing Mechathun Druid yesterday and finding some success with it. There's Mechathun Warlock, which finds a way to reduce the cost of Mechathun by 2 and then gets to cheat out a spell called Cataclysm, your entire hand, and destroys your entire board. So is there you go. That's another way.
Is that a Warlock-specific card, or is it a neutral card?
A Warlock-specific spell, yeah.
Oh, okay. So Cataclysm,
that one only works in Warlock. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's even Mechathun Priest, which is kind of convoluted, so I won't describe the whole combo, but it's certainly my favorite, where you use a card called Hemet Jungle Hunter, which destroys all cards in your deck that cost 3 or less, and then you play a number of Death Rattle minions in a specific order. So I think we're going to be seeing more and more Mechathun decks. Eventually, maybe one or two will kind of emerge as the de facto best Mechathun decks. But definitely expect to see this card. It's probably more powerful than a lot of people expected, but it's really sweet, so I'm totally okay with that.
Nice. All right. Well, I didn't expect, me neither, for it to be usable. What about decks that have started emerging from... at the time of recording, it's only been like 24 hours since the expansion has been released, so things aren't set in stone by any stretch. But anything fun that's already taking shape?
Yeah, so I think the earliest like kind of standout, if you want to call it that, because again, it's very early, would be like Togwaggle Druid. That was actually King Togwaggle is a card I think we talked about a while ago and immediately dismissed as awful. But a few cards have come out since then, which have actually made it quite good. The deck I really want to talk about is this Topsy-Turvy Combo Priest, or as the streamer Dog has been calling it, APM Priest. Where you have to do something like, it feels like 100 or more independent game actions during your combo turn to actually kill the opponent. So your actions per minute is actually very relevant.
During one turn?
Yeah.
What?
It's a ton.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to, there's quite a few cards going on here, so I'm going to try to simplify this explanation as much as possible. But basically you play 2 Radiant Elementals, which is this card. It's a card that reduces the cost of all your spells by 1. Then you play this new card called Test Subject, which says when it dies, it returns all of the cards that you've played on it to your hand. So
that
you create a copy of that.
That you played on it. That you played on the Test Subject. Okay.
Exactly. So you create a copy of the Test Subject with a card called Vivid Nightmare. You can kill the Test Subject with a new 0 mana spell called Topsy Turvy, which flips around the attack in the health of a minion.
It has 0 attack, right. Okay.
So instantly 0 health and it dies. And then whenever you topsy-turvy it, you get back to your hand the topsy-turvy and then whichever spells that you use to copy it or buff it up. So each time you put Vivid Night on it. You're getting one more copy of Vivid Nightmare back to your hand. You can also be getting more and
Wait, what is Vivid Nightmare again?
The copy spell. The one that creates a copy of the minion in play, except it gives it one health. But that's not a big deal. We don't care if it has one health, since we're going to be doing 100 things in one turn, and we're never going to attack with it, right?
Okay. I'm very curious to hear where you actually start getting stuff that you can attack with, but keep going.
Yeah, so this is, you actually kill with a Stone Tusk Boar, which is the 1-mana 1/1 charge. You basically loop through this thing over and over and over. You have to do it I think like 5 or 6 times to make a bunch of copies of Divine Spirit, which doubles the health of your minion. And then you create a Stone Tusk Boar with a bunch of health. You topsy-turvy it, so now it has a bunch of attack and one health, but again, that doesn't matter. You can just punch your opponent right in the face for a bunch of damage.
Oh, okay. So basically, you use that test subject to multiply the cards that will let you increase the power of the abilities of the Stone Tusk Boar, and you do it 5 or 6 times, and then you play the boar, play everything, buff it to hell, topsy-turvy it, and basically face attack with that buffed stone. So the goal of the deck is to get to a turn where you can play enough of the test subject to acquire a lot of spells to buff the Stone Tusk Boar.
Exactly, that's it.
So the only thing you need is to have maybe 4 cards in your hand, get to, let's say, turn 5 or 6, and have the opponent not have minion?
A taunt minion?
A taunt minion, yeah. That's what you need, right? Mm.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of it. What's cool is that you get all these extra copies of Vivid Nightmare, so you can actually make, I think I've seen boards where, people had like 4 Stone Tusk Boars that were like 96 ones on it. So you could actually kill through several taunt minions. I think if your opponent had 8 taunt minions, it might be tricky, but you can actually kill. It's surprisingly resilient and does a ton of damage. You can deal something like 500 damage in a turn with this deck. I think you need about 6 cards and you need to draw a bit of your deck to get there. But Dog, which is the player who popularized this, was getting a lot of kills on turn 7 with this deck. So it seems pretty good, but it's very, very difficult. So if you're a newer player or you're not a very experienced combo player, you're probably going to not do very well with this deck when you're first starting out with it.
And just to reiterate, the initial key to all of this is to have 2 Radiant Elementals in place, which each reduce the cost of your spells by 1. And since the spells you play cost very little, basically 2, you just play the spells repeatedly and they all cost 0.
Yeah, exactly. So the first ones are going to cost you 1 because Vivid Nightmare costs 3. But eventually when you have a copy of Vivid Nightmare, you can use one to make a 3rd copy of the Radiant Elementals. So from that point forward, everything you're playing for the rest of the turn
costs 0. Okay. All right. So you play the first Radiant Elemental for 2 and then you play the Vivid Nightmare do you play the initial 2 Radiant Elementals? Oh no, you only need 1.
Because it works with 2 Radiant Elementals and 1 Vivid Nightmare, or with 1 Radiant Elemental and 2 Vivid Nightmare.
Right. So you have the option there. But then you already have used 6 mana, right? You've already used 6 mana.
Yeah, it's about 6, and then I think you need a 7th to create the final copy, and then an 8th for the Stone Tusk Boar. I think that's right.
Okay, so it's still kind of... But the test subject costs 1, so how do you get 1. Out of that one?
So you just play that along with the Radiant Elementals. So it's 2 mana for the Radiant, 2 mana for the Radiant, 1 mana for the test subject, 1 mana for a copy of Radiant, or 1 for another, 1 mana for another one. I think it's... I could be wrong. I watched a lot of this deck. I didn't play it. I think it's 7 or 6 mana total to do the whole combo.
But then the test subject, you play it once, you buff it, and then you kill it with the topsy-turvy, but then you have to play it again to get more of the copies of your buff spells.
Well, you're copying the original one many times and killing off the copied one each time. So you never have to play multiple copies of the... of the test subject from hand. You'd run just 1 in the whole deck.
Right. So you run one and then you copy it with Vivid Nightmare, which you get which you get again and again, because when you destroy the test subject, it re-gives you a Vivid Nightmare.
Exactly. Right. So you have to battle hand size a little bit because you're getting more and more copies of Vivid Nightmare to your hand each time. So you do have to kind of get some practice into the deck to play through, like, okay, how much hand size do I need? How many copies do I really need? Can I do this from this spot or not? But so it for a mad science themed deck, for a theme set, this is perfect, right? You totally feel like a mad scientist when you're like trying to blast through all these things. It feels like you're mixing little potions together and stuff. And it does seem strong, but it's very difficult and very, very cool. So I at least was happy as a combo fan to see a deck like this kind of take off on day one. We'll see if it sticks around or not, but the fact that something like this can even exist in the game where you have to have really a very high APM to pull this off, that's the kind of direction that I'm really happy to see the game turn in, at least.
Yeah, it is very original, at the very least. It's completely, I've never seen that kind of philosophy for a deck in the game, so that's interesting. All right, well, that is your example for this time. I'm sure we'll have more decks, fun decks to describe in the future episodes. But if you want to see a lot of them, you, Aleko, you made a list of 18 18 decks for this expansion that people can go and take a look at and see if there's one that they like.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the articles I work hardest on, I think, at least for any given expansion or for the whole year. I try to make a bunch of decks for day one that people can try out. Unfortunately, by the time you're listening to this, they're probably going to be slightly outdated because, you know, it's already day two, but that's okay. what I'd really recommend doing is checking out our deck guides section on Icy Veins. We already have quite a few up. I've written a guide for Malagos Rogue and for the Boommaster Flark Mech Hunter deck, which is really cool. Our other writer, Kat, already has guides up for the aforementioned Topsy-Turvy combo and for Mechathune Druid. So if you're interested in like a more detailed description of how either of those decks work, I would highly recommend checking out those guides. And there's going to be many, many more coming in the following days as well.
Excellent. So ic-veins.com for all the guides for your Boomsday needs. Let's talk a little bit about Overwatch. We just had 10 days ago the finals for the first season of the Overwatch League. And that was obviously very exciting if you're into Overwatch and if you're into Overwatch esports. We've said many times that they have done a pretty good job at making the viewing experience of the esports version of Overwatch pretty interesting with the colors and the UI and the commentary. I noticed that for the finals, the commentators were trying to be really not educational, but explain the basic concepts of most of the things they were saying so that first-time viewers might understand what was happening. So the finals happened between the London Spitfire and the Philadelphia Fusion, and it's been long enough, I think we can spoil it, but the London Spitfire won, and it was divided into best of three series of best of five matches. So it was divided in 2 days. First day they would play a first series of best of fives, and the second day they would play the second series and maybe the third if it was a tie. And what happened was that the London Spitfire the first day was really nail-biting because the Spitfire had been on a super strong streak for the past few matches, and they really gave the Fusion had been on a good streak, and they really gave the Spitfire a run for their money. But the second day was kind of a little bit of a letdown because the Spitfire basically walked all over the Fusion. Which was definitely a bit disappointing. It was anticlimactic. But overall, I would say that from the semifinals to the finals and maybe even the quarterfinals, it was like basically the playoffs, it was such entertaining Overwatch to watch. I know, Aleko, you've been watching a little bit as well. Did you enjoy it, or was it kind of, you know, samey all the time, or what did you think?
Well, other than the finals day two, which, like you mentioned, was a roll, I really enjoyed all of the playoffs, actually, that I watched. I tried to watch as much of it as I possibly could, and there were a lot of really tight matches, a lot of people, you know, coming up in the clutch at really big moments. And it was just a little disappointing that, like, kind of this, you know, big esports kind of bursting onto the main stage of, like, mainstream media, at least in America, by, you know, having the Overwatch League finals on ESPN, kind of resulted in a bit of a one-sided match. Mm. But all of the matches leading up to that, the ones that were on Twitch and such, were really, really entertaining matches. Definitely, I think, some of the best Overwatch all season, for sure, if you'd been following the Overwatch League for a while.
Yeah, that was really exciting. And the matches, again, except for the second series of the finals, were mostly very unpredictable. And even the team that is considered the best team in the league, we mentioned this in the previous episode of the podcast, was taken out in the semifinals, the New York Excelsior. So it was, I mean, the one thing I will say is that I was kind of hoping that it wouldn't be an all-Korean team that would win, not for any nationalistic reasons or anything like that, but it's just the Koreans are so good at every game they play. I would have hoped that, you know, for once we would have a team that is mixed, because the Fusion is basically half Korean, half non-Korean, and they really had a shot. I would have hoped that someone else would win for once, or at least part of someone else. But really, the Spitfire were unstoppable. And in pure Korean gaming fashion, they were undoubtedly, on the second day, the best of the two teams. I think the Fusion was at the end of their rope. And I'm really looking forward to see what's going to be happening in the season two, which will happen next year. The finals had a pretty good viewership, an average viewership of almost 900,000 people. That's average, so that's a lot of people. They revealed a couple of skins, etc., etc. There's also going to be an all-star match in August, towards the end of August. That is one I think that you're not going to want to miss. It's basically the Western Conference versus the Eastern Conference with the best players from every team, which is really going to be fun, I think, for people to look at. It's kind of an Avengers of Overwatch esports. So that's going to be fun, I'm pretty sure.
But I'm definitely looking forward to that one.
Yeah. But overall, I think the Overwatch League has had a good first season, first year. And it wasn't explosive, but it didn't. Some people were worried that it would fall flat after the beginning, and I don't think it did. I think they did really well. The matches were interesting, and the viewership was there until the end. So pretty successful first season, inaugural season for the Overwatch League. And we know they're announcing more teams. We already have a couple which weren't Paris, so I wasn't interested as a French person. We suspect that Paris is coming fairly soon, and maybe a few others. So we'll see how that goes for season two. We probably have until, I guess, October for new teams to be announced. And the last thing is the summer games are coming back this week. And that, I will say, I'm kind of, unless they do something completely different with the summer games, I'm a bit disappointed that they don't have a different kind of event. It seems like Lucio Bowl is coming back, and there might be a little bit of a change, maybe some team-up things, we don't know. But it seems like it's still Lucio Bowl. So I'm kind of not looking forward to having the events in the game be the same year after year after year. And this is at least now the third year that we're getting the same events. So I don't know. I think that's a bit underwhelming. I would love to see new types of events for the game. The skins, however, are really cool. There are a few that I'm very much looking forward to maybe getting, very obviously sports themed, and I'm sure our American listeners will be very happy to see, you know, American football and baseball inspired skins for Reinhardt and Winston and et cetera, et cetera. So that I'm sure is going to be a big success. There's Cabana Anna, which is really cool. There's a bunch of others. So yeah, this is coming, I think, tomorrow. I can't remember when it starts, but it's this week. So probably by the time you listen to this, yeah, it is tomorrow, the 9th. So it will be here very soon.
All about that Wave Racer Diva skin, though. That's the one I'm looking forward to.
It is pretty nice. I admit. I saw something about a Tuxedo Hammond, which I can't remember where I saw this. I saw it in passing. I can't remember if it was actually announced or some kind of rumor. But if we get a hamster in a tuxedo, I'm just going to die. I don't know. It seems like the cutest thing ever. So we'll see if that comes to pass. But why would there be a Tuxedo Hammond for the, you know, summer games? That wouldn't make sense. All right, a quick detour via Heroes with the release of Sally Whitemane, the High Inquisitor of the Scarlet Crusade. So the character was announced a couple of weeks ago, and it's been on PTR. It's now been released. Wait, has it been released? Yes, it has been released.
Yep, yesterday it went live in America, and now it should be live in Europe.
There you go. So what's the gist of Whitemane? Every time the new character is released, it works a little bit differently mechanically than the others. So what's the thing for this one? Wait, what's happening? There's an update for Diablo?
Yeah, on behalf of the some Diablo news about the future of Diablo. Finally, they spoke up.
But what did they say? Nothing much.
I'm not
but
sure
they're saying
it's a video,
something
so.
Is going to. Something is. You know what? Let's take a quick break. We'll watch it and be right back. All right, we've
okay,
watched
so
it.
We're back and we're talking about High Inquisitor Sally Whitemane. So she is kind of an interesting character because
All right. There, I do want to say
recording?
One thing. Yes, we are recording. I do want to say one thing. There's basically this announcement is an announcement, and they're just saying, hey, we did the seasons, the themed seasons. What's the name of the Diablo seasons? Anyway, they have like a different kind of season, but they do say we have multiple Diablo projects in the works, and some of them are going to be take more time than others. But we'll have news hopefully this year. So this is either a Gamescom announcement or a BlizzCon announcement. They're basically saying we're going to hear about a new Diablo game at Gamescom or BlizzCon. So there is a little bit of something in that non-announcement. All right, that's
Diablo it. Battle Royale confirmed.
Probably. That's probably what it is. Let's be realistic. Right, so anyway, all right, Diablo section over. Now we go on to Heroes and High Inquisitor Whitemane.
Okay, so High Inquisitor Whitemane, if you've been playing Disco Priest in WoW, so she has a pretty similar trait. So first of all, she is a flexible healer, and her trait basically makes her abilities the damage she causes to her enemies will heal the friendly targets. So the more damage she deals, the more healing will she do to her targets. So it's kind of interesting. Okay. High reward, high risk, high reward hero, but she really lacks self-sustain as well as escaping opportunities.
I see. So she's a heal your friends through damaging your enemies kind of character.
Yes.
How does she heal? Like, she puts that glowy thing on her teammates, and then when she does damage to anyone, all of the ones that have the glowy thing, that's the technical term for it, by the way, they all get healed. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so her healing abilities apply heal for 8 seconds to targets. That's her trait. And allies heal are healed for 100% of the damage she deals. So, for example, she also has, like, her Q ability is called Desperate Plea, and that will heal an allied hero for a certain amount and gain and apply desperation to the target, which increases the mana cost of her next healing spell, I mean Desperate Plea, by certain portion, which stacks up to 3 times. So the more times she ability, for example, the more mana she will lose. So it's also about mana management or resource management, if you will.
Okay, so there are two main pillars, the zeal that she will apply to her teammates and that will then heal them for 100% of the damage she does, and that don't use up all of your mana ability of Desperate Plea, which allows you to bring up allies really quickly, but then you're out of mana and you die. So you have to... True. Play between the two.
Basically, yeah, like as a support, you deal damage, and the more damage you deal, the more you heal your friendly allies. So it's kind of high risk, high reward. And the fact that she has virtually no escape opportunities makes her skill ceiling go up.
Okay, I see. So she's basically, her weakness is her lack of mobility.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so with the White Mane patch, also known as Viper skins for Ana, Genji, and Stukov, I think. So that's kind of interesting. And we also got a rework for Chromie and Stukov. So their both talents have been updated.
Okay, I guess this is a light rework. It's not like the big ones we sometimes have with changes the way they play.
This has been made as part of the latest content patch, so it's live right now.
Okay, cool. Well, if you want the... basically super evil Viper skins, you can go that go get them now as well. It has a feeling of not Power Rangers, what's the name of that Saturday morning cartoon in the US which is very popular? Geez, G.I. Joe, I guess. What's the enemy? Cobra in G.I. Joe? I didn't watch that, but I think it's basically, it looks a little bit like Cobra to me, but at the same time I didn't watch G.I. Joe, so maybe I don't actually know what I'm talking about, which is quite common for me. All right, so let's get to the actual main course of this episode, which is World of Warcraft and the War of Thorns that has been taking place, Stan is happy, taking place in the game as a lead up to the actual expansion coming out in just a few days. The War of Thorns was a series of 3 steps in the quests that we would bring to a head the explosive conflict between the Horde and Alliance that sets up both factions going to their respective continent in Battle for Azeroth to seek help and allies in these lands to help them fight the opposing faction. And as we have kind of discussed many times over the past few months, I would say, there's a deep... not even rift, but not anger. People are unhappy with the way Sylvanas is being developed as a war chief and as a character. We mentioned it back in the spring, I think, when you first read, or in June, when you first read Before the Storm, and you said that Sylvanas was not very well developed and her motivations weren't clear. I sort of poo-pooed that estimate because I thought, you know, the novel was great up to the point that I had read, but then I kind of understood what you were where you were coming from and agreed that Sylvanas was not very well developed. And the step 2 of the War of Thorns has kind of made this explode onto the general public, because I think the main question that everyone had... and by the way, super big spoilers. If you haven't played any of this yet, stop listening now. Go play all of it and then come back, although I suspect you have probably seen what happens already. But one of the big questions we had since BlizzCon was who is going to burn the World Tree, right? Who's going to go to Darnassus and destroy the city and burn the World Tree? And
yeah,
I think everyone was looking forward to having a scenario where you could
People were expecting false flags for that.
You what, sorry?
That people were expecting false flags for that. You know, like someone blames the Horde for burning down Teldrassil and stuff like that. But War of Thorns revealed a fact that basically it coincided with the second Warbringers animated short. And it was revealed that actually Sylvanas burned down the tree. So people were going rampant across the forums, attacking Blizzard and stuff like that. But actually the novel describes this a lot better and more detail.
So, yeah, I want to hear about this because it's not just that she burned the World Tree, it's that she burned it for essentially no reason. I mean, you can say, yes, yeah, it is to extinguish the hope of the Alliance, or at least the Night Elves, and to make sure that they are left broken after this. But really, that's kind of a tenuous motivation for it. It's basically she wakes up in the morning and she's like, oh, let's conquer Darnassus. Why? Well, there's Azerite trading, you know, lines that you can get from there. All right, sure, but you're going to attack the city of, like, the one of the main cities of the Alliance for this? Well, yeah, she will. And, oh, there's this guard that is telling me stuff I don't like. Well, I'm going to burn the symbol of hope and life of the Alliance just to make sure that they're going to be so angry, they're going to come to my city and destroy it, which is actually what happens in part 3. She gains basically nothing out of doing what she does. In the end, after the battle for Lordaeron has happened, her super powerful Azerite weapon was destroyed in 2 minutes. She gassed her own people as well as the enemy, so she killed everyone. She retreated and she fled her city. She captured no one, killed no valuable asset from the enemy faction, and she destroyed her city. So what has she achieved? Nothing.
Okay, she achieved pretty much everything she wanted to achieve. Just read the novel, really. Because people just watched the movie, I mean the cinematic, and they thought, okay, so Dilaren told her some stuff, she went bonkers, and that's it. But if you actually read the novel, and I really need to say that Blizzard writers did a poor job at interpreting the lore in-game. It really sucked in-game. They don't give you any reasons as to her motives, why she burned the tree down. But as opposed to the book, it really tells you everything, how cunning she is and how they discussed the stuff with Sorfang at the world table in Orgrimmar. And it's really detailed. And she gives an insight why she actually burned down the tree. So
just to be clear, Stan, you're talking about the novel, but it's actually the small novellas. Right. So A Good War and Elegy are two novellas, so very short novels, that were available in the that are available in the collector's edition as like physical products, but that were released as PDFs a couple of days ago, and I haven't read them yet, so I'm very curious to get through that. But you're saying that at least A Good War, which is the kind of Horde side of the explanation for the conflict, is well written and kind of explains her motivations a lot better than what we've seen until now, sort of satisfied you with why she does what she does?
Yes, I mean, it could be always be false logic, you know, Sylvanas, but I really love that because they discussed war plans with Sorfang himself, you know, because Sylvanas told him, you are the only person I know who has conquered Stormwind, so I'm asking you, would it be possible for the Horde to conquer it? And if so, how? And they discussed these plans, and Sylvanas specifically told that she wants to inflict a wound that can never heal. And basically, that was to take down one of the leaders, so either Malfurion or Tirande. But as you know, Malfurion, Sorfang did not deliver the fatal blow to Malfurion, so she took matters into her own hands and decided to burn down the tree.
As an alternative to killing one of the leaders. But why does she want to inflict a blow that, you know, never heals? Because
she knows that Stormwind has a good strategic location. You know, it has docks inside of the town as opposed to Orgrimmar, which has docks near the town. And she wants to, because Anduin is very inexperienced, right? And she wants to take the Horde Alliance leaders one by one and basically dissolve the alliance, because as Anduin is really inexperienced, and if all leaders wanted different things from him, that would cause trouble in the alliance, and that what she basically wants to profit from.
But okay, so I guess she wants war because she wants war, which already is not a great motivation, I would say. But sure, fine. Because some people say, oh, but you know, the war is always going to happen between the Horde and Alliance. But at this juncture in time, the king of the Alliance is ridiculously anti-war. He's being made fun of because he's such a Boy Scout that he's always going around going like, oh, we need peace and we need to love each other. So she's not under threat of war. You know, maybe she's saying, oh, but at some point in the future, it will happen. But it seems like it's still poor motivation for going and provoking that kind of all-out attack where she loses.
Basically, the logic she applies is that, you know, right now, the Horde and the Alliance are really crippled from the defeat of the Burning Legion.
Okay. Right?
So they have limited resources at their disposal, as well as ships and other means for war, and she thinks that with the possession of Azeroth and with waiting more, it's worth for her to attack now than wait, for example, I don't know, X couple of years, and she wants to secure peace for at least 100 years, you know. So she decided to attack now whilst the other faction is really crippled from the defeat of the Burning Legion, and thinks that it would be better to do that now because the factions have not yet made full power or understanding of Azeroth, and that future wars would have even more casualties.
Okay, I think it's that's really, still
it's a flawed logic, I think, yeah. But she is described as a cunning leader. I mean, she made everything she wanted.
Yeah, I think one of the issues, well, everything she wanted, no, she didn't kill any, well, yeah, I guess she burned the world tree, okay, but she arguably she has secured the lines of the ways of getting the Azeroth, but as we've said, the Azeroth weapon was destroyed in the scenario very quickly, so it doesn't seem like Azeroth is that great. But she acts the way a tyrant would, and yes, there is logic in that, but it feels a little bit frustrating because in many examples we've seen, the characters that were quote-unquote bad had their own internal logic you could get behind. Like Arthas, when he does the culling of Stratholm, you understand why he does it. You might think it's horrible, but you understand why he does it. Illidan, when he becomes a demon and goes into... They've retconned it a little bit with the novel and Legion, but you understand why he did all of this, and the conflict came from people seeing things a different way. Here, I guess you could get behind Sylvanas becoming a tyrant and saying, I'm going to end the war before it starts, which, as Captain America says, every time you try to end a war before it starts, innocent people get hurt. Right? We all remember that very wise phrase from our favorite superhero. So you could get behind that logic, but I still think it's the kind of logic that tyrants and you know, the people we consider evil throughout history have. So it feels bad for the Horde.
It feels weird, but I really love her character development. I think, you know, when they discussed war plans with Sorfang, right? So she already knew that when I attack Tal Drassil, the people, the Alliance will attack either Silvermoon City or Undercity. So she knew exactly what would the repercussions of her attacks be.
Mm. So she realized what she was doing, and she knew she was probably going to have to torch and her city if she didn't succeed.
Yeah, and one thing I really hate is the idleness of Alliance characters. I mean, Malfurion and Tyrande are one of the most powerful creatures in Warcraft lore, right? And they do totally nothing.
Well, they're hurt from the attack. They're still
beating. So be hurt, but what? At least try to help. I mean, Anduin nobody really helped. But they had a portal up that would take refugees to Stormwind from Tal Drassil, but none of them really cared to help anything.
I agree, but I think there you get into game logic. I mean, obviously,
I still need to read Elegy. I mean, someone told me that it's a really good book. We discussed this with Sophia yesterday. How the heck cannot the forces, because Both factions were really crippled by the defeat of the Legion, and their naval power was bad, right? And I was thinking, why the heck do they not use portals? You know, they have magis, and why cannot they use them?
But again, that's game logic. Yeah. You know, it's and they do get help in the glorious appearance of Jaina, which shows up out of nowhere in a super badass way with her flying mana ship, which
that was so cool.
Yeah, so
I loved it, really.
Yeah, I think overall people kind of agree on the basics of it. The rift comes from some people who support Sylvanas unequivocally, and those who in the Horde think, well, no, she's going too far, as is very clearly exemplified by Blizzard having both Sourfang and Bane, Bloodhoof, disapprove very strongly of her actions. So that's interesting, because they're not, you know, they're clearly saying some people in the Horde don't like her. And as is the case with players, some players are just like, yeah, war, Sylvanas, she's my war chief.
Yeah.
And some people are saying, well, yeah, you know, that's kind of not great. And we got something that we never get, which is a full cinematic a few days before the release of the expansion, with the old soldier cinematic, where not only does Sourfang show his melancholy, I guess, but also we get Zappy Boy, who has become a giant meme on the Warcraft internet. So I guess
did you like the cinematic?
I thought it was interesting. I thought it was necessary to show why people are still willing to fight for the Horde. Whether or not you agree with Sylvanas, actually, if you don't agree with Sylvanas, you have this feeling that you only have one Horde and you have to fight for it, because the alternative is unacceptable, which would be just drop your weapons and let the Horde be not just vanquished, because that you can recover from, but kind of the soul of the Horde is dissolved. It doesn't really exist anymore. And there are the people of the Horde who form the Horde, not her, the leader. So there's this weird dichotomy where you disagree with the leader, because you are part of the Horde, you still are going to follow her and do what she says because she's your leader. There's a very I don't know, like loyalty, but hurt loyalty theme, which makes it better, I think.
Yeah, basically, for example, I'm a Horde fanboy, right? But I don't really agree with what Sylvanas did. So I think, but I tried to look the logic, you know, because I'm a really rational person. So I wanted to read the novel to find out her motives behind the stuff she did. So,
but did the Sourfang cinematic get you to think, well, okay, she sucks, but I'm still going to fight for the Horde?
You know, the Sourfang cinematic, it was really amazing CGI, like props to that. But apart from that, it really sucked. I mean,
you didn't like it.
No, you have 6 minutes of a cinematic, right? Duration, 6 minutes, plot, 1 minute. I really hate that. It was just him fighting him having a PTSD syndrome, fighting Zappy Boy. Poor Zappy Boy. He threw him around like, I don't know what.
No, but it's him having a crisis of faith. And
I know,
he lost everything, and he decides that the Horde is not... Basically, he's going through the emotional journey that maybe some players are going through about the Horde. He realizes that the Horde is not the Horde he fights for, and it's dishonorable. And
but, I mean, he's so
Zappy
old.
Boy How brings him back.
Everything evolves, you know. He's old. Sourfang should, I don't know, he just should die his honorable death and just... Yeah,
well, that's the thing. He's not given, even in the battle for Lordaeron, he's not given that honorable death. And I'm very curious to see what will happen. I mean, once we go into the actual expansion, this kind of gets pushed to the side, and we do the things that we do on Kul Tiras and Zendalar, is it?
And only to see how the thing evolves, really.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting how it evolves later.
Won't be the war chief, because that would suck.
You know, I think they've shown with Legion that they can lead us in a direction and then surprise us with where they go.
Surprises big time, yeah.
Yeah, so I think they're all basically leading to the idea that Sylvanas is going to be, you know, somehow replaced by Sourfang as the leader of the Horde. This is what most people would say, yeah, this looks like it's going that way. But given the teachings we've had in Legion, I think they're not going to do that. And I'm very curious to see where they're going to go.
Basically expect the unexpected.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was Taliesin and Evitel who were saying, maybe she's going to win. Maybe Sylvanas is going to win the war. And what do you do then? You know, that's a very, like, because obviously we're used to the bad guy losing. What happens if the bad guy wins? That could be a really interesting story beat for the game, which would be unexpected. But I don't know. We'll see.
Would be called World of Warcraft Infinity War 1.
Basically, she's a little bit of Thanos. I was thinking about this, like a bad guy, you can understand why they're doing the thing they're doing, but they're still crazy. Although I understand less of Sylvanas than I understand Thanos, which is saying something. All right, so I guess the WoW section today will have been just lore and discussion of how the story has been happening. We'll talk about everything in the expansion next time. The expansion will have been out for a couple of weeks already, already, and that will be fun to discuss. But for now, this is going to be it for WoW, and we have one tiny bit of StarCraft news, actually. The patch 4.5 has been released, and there's a war chest which is available in the patch. The war chest is basically a bunch of in-game items you can buy for real money, and that's the war chest for season 3, which shows you how little I know about StarCraft, because I didn't realize that was a thing. I guess there was a war chest for season 2 and season 1 as well, which gave you other like skins for your units and a bunch of other things. And it's a bit expensive. It's $10 per faction, or $25 if you want to buy the whole package, but it's only cosmetic stuff. And there's a few other bug fixes in the patch, but generally it's the arrival of the war chest. So if you're into StarCraft, you can go support the game you like with the purchase of the war chest. And that is going to be it for the episode. Thank you so much to both of you for being along with me for this ride. Aleko, sorry to wake you up. You've been silent for a little while since Overwatch. where can people find you if they want more of your brand of fun on the internet?
The best place to find me is going to be in the Hearthstone section over on Icy Veins. I'm going to be writing plenty of deck guides, and I'm going to try to do some early meta reports as well for this early Boomstay Project meta. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I am at @Aleko_P over there.
Excellent. Stan, what about yourself?
So as usual, covering news from Blizzard Games, mainly WoW Heroes. You can find me over at ic-veins.com and on Twitter under @HeroesPawn.
Excellent. And next week, we're going to basically be disappearing from everywhere to play Battle for Azeroth, I assume. So don't look for us on the internet on the 14th or 15th or 16th, or maybe for a few days after that. But if you do want to look for me before or after, I'm Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and you can find my gaming show, general gaming show called Pixels, on your podcast app. It's a show that covers the entire industry. If you enjoy my brand of silly humor and banter, you can find more of it and talking about games that aren't Blizzard games on this show called Pixels. So go to your podcast app, search for Pixels, subscribe, and be happy. That's going to be it for this episode. We will talk to you again in the next one in a couple of weeks. Enjoy the battle for Azeroth. Bye.
Goodbye. Later.